Today I'm going to speak to David William Voorhees, who is director and head of the Jacob Leisler Institute in Hudson. Thank you very much, Mr. Voorhees, for letting me interview.
Okay. Thank you, Rob. It's an honor to be speaking with you.
When did the first Dutch explorer land and walk on the present or riverfront of Hudson?
Henry Hudson, ship de Havemann, is believed to have landed at Stockport Creek on September 17th, 1609. Various European traders arrived in the area shortly thereafter. So in the decade after Hudson's arrival, you will find some Hudson Dutch explorers in the area, walking on the shore here.
What Native Americans lived in the area of Clavering Landing, Hudson?
Mohicans or Mahicans. Now, these are not to be confused with the Mohicans of Connecticut. Mohicans who lived in the area at the time of the European settlement. They were a tribe of the Lenni Lenapes or of the Algonquian linguistic group. At the time of the early settlement, the Mohawk Iroquois, and to their east, the Mohicans in Connecticut, who, despite their similar-sounding names, were competitive nations.
When did settlers arrive, and what kind of commerce developed at Clavering Landing?
Well, the first permanent settler in the region would have been the Abraham Stats House on Stockport Creek, which was built about 1652 to 1654. That is generally believed to be the first European settler home in the area. Now, Stats did not live there himself. It was occupied by tenants of Stats. Native American Indians burned down the house and killed the original tenant and abducted his wife. But the structure was rebuilt again in 1664, and as you know, it still stands to this day. Jan Frans van Hoosen, then living in Albany, purchased in 1662 from Mohican Indians Pemetapete and Tatankenet, the tract of land that included the present city of Hudson and the town of Greenport in 1662. This was confirmed by Sikanik, another Indian, in 1664. Van Hoosen, however, never lived on the tract. English Governor Richard Nicholas confirmed the purchase by letters of patent on May 14, 1667. But it was after 1667 that permanent settlement commenced by the tenants and some of the children of Jan Frans. So that is the beginning of Clavering Landing.
Where would the homes be, right by the river or along the river?
They would have been along the river. At that point in time, the only access would have been by water.
Would there be people going inland and settling in from?
The Van Rensselaers at the same time were establishing farms on Clavering Creek, along the creek. And so there was a road that went from the landing up to the creek and up to those farms.
Would that be a particular toll road or one of the roads left today?
No, the road still exists today, and you can follow it. It's recognizable today. It followed the Rue de Furry and Partition Street to Green Street to 23B and out toward the creek. It's known as the Old Wagon Way. And it led from the wharf, which was developed on the river, landing to the interior farms, and passed nearly along the line of Furry and Partition Streets. So it was one of the surviving elements of that period.
Was it mostly farming?
The landing itself was consisted of several stores and storage buildings for the farmers, for the trade with the farmers.
Would commerce goods would come what? Come up the river by boats for the settlers?
The manufactured goods would come up and be exchanged for mostly wheat. So the main trade item, export item of the farms was wheat in this period, or grains, various grains. And also, surprisingly, lime from Beecraft Mountain was also being exported.
That's very interesting, because that lime played a great part later.
Right. So it has a very long history in the history of this area.
Do you know of particular families, you know, once it settled, that were prominent?
Well, they almost all were the descendants of Jan Frans van Huysen and his relations, such as the Hartwig family, and the Van Allens, so the Hochebohms. There were various families that married into the family or descended from tenants that occupied Van Huysen properties.
Would you say that it was a lively trading post at that time?
Well, we're talking about a 120-year period, yeah. So there's ups and downs, and as the population increased and the farming increased in this area, trade, of course, increased, and the prominence of the landing increased. The landing also became more important with the development of Lunenburg, or Athens, across the river as a ferry crossing.
Also, there was trade between, commerce between both Athens and Clover.
Well, it's very interesting in that this area, the Van Huysens were Lutheran, which was unusual. And Lunenburg, of course, was established by Lutherans. So a Lutheran congregation became established very early in the 18th century in Lunenburg, and so that many of the inhabitants of Claverick Landing then would cross over the river to attend services there or have their children baptized.
That's something I didn't know about, but it's nice to know.
So it's one of the very interesting aspects of this area. As you perhaps know, the Dutch Reformed Church, or the Reformed Church, was the major religion in New Netherland, and after the English took over, it remained the major denomination in the Hudson River Valley. But there was this Lutheran element, which was particularly prominent in this region.
And the language was probably mostly Dutch.
They actually spoke Dutch up until probably the 1830s, the people around here, very late. And in the Hudson River Valley, Dutch was used up until the 20th century in some places, in Bergen County or up in the Mohawk Valley. So it was long-lasting. Now, we have to be careful, because it is not the Dutch of the Netherlands. What happens is you develop a regional dialect here, somewhat akin to Afrikaans in South Africa. So it's a provincial dialect, and there actually developed several regional dialects within that dialect. One is Mohawk Valley Dutch, another is Jersey Dutch. So, but they did speak Dutch.
So a person here would recognize a Bergen Dutchman. It'd be different. It would be like a dialect?
Yes. As early as 1690, it was noted that the people in the Hudson River Valley spoke a different form of Dutch than was being spoken in the Netherlands at that point in time. It had already begun to evolve.
Was there a connection between Albany and Claverick Landing?
Well, definitely, because Jan Frans van Huysen lived in Albany, and Albany was the I guess you could call it the metropolitan center for this area, as it still is today. And so there was a very close connection.
But you said the Van Rensselaers owned a lot of Claverick.
Well, they received a patent for what is now known as the Lower Manor, which is centered in Claverick. The Lower Manor House still stands in Claverick. I got lost in your question now.
No, it's just I wonder if they remain prominent for decades and decades.
Well, yes, the manor is, this goes beyond the period we're speaking of, but in the 1840s, you have the anti-rent wars. Mm-hmm. Because the manors, Livingston Manor, Van Rensselaer Manor, which were in this area, were still medieval tenant manorial holdings. And there were large uprisings that occurred, and they had a particular prominence in the history of Hudson at that point in time, in the 1840s.
What kind of artifacts have been found around here?
I can't say that Hudson has been very good with archaeological excavations. So I'm sure that people have found pipe stems. I'm sure that they have found perhaps, I know I found a musket ball, which may date from the 18th century in my own yard. But I can't say there's been a really concerted effort to do archaeological excavations in this area. Now, they are occurring right now with the Jan van Husen house, which is out on 66, Route 66.
Are they working on it? I know where that is.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yes, they are working there. And they've been doing archaeological investigations there.
So that survives?
That survives from the early 18th century. Now, there's almost nothing survives from the 17th century. The original homes were very impermanent. They weren't, they were built probably of wood, and we have some building contracts from the period. They were not grand homes. The earliest farms may have been in the tradition of the Netherland, farm, barn, being combined into one building. Very early, they begin to be separated. But in the 18th century, prosperity sweeps through this region, and that's when you begin to find the substantial brick houses being built.
And we're talking about before the proprietors. We're talking about this period of 1700s, those earlier decades.
Right. We're only talking up to when the proprietors come in.
But there's still a big chunk of time in the 1700s.
Oh, yes. Well, we're dealing, as I said, after the Dutch, after the English come in, you have a 120-year period between 1664 and 1784 when the proprietors arrive. So,
do we know possibly how many people were living here before the proprietors?
In Clavering Landing or in the whole camp, on the whole area?
Clavering
Landing, there were probably about 150 people. Ten families, more or less, and about 150 people, which is, you know, it's a nice little village.
What kind of boundaries? The Clavering Landing, maybe we can talk about the boundaries of it.
Well, the boundaries of the landing, of course, when Hudson, when the proprietors purchased Hudson, it included also Greenport. It was a much larger area. And Clavering Landing would also have included a much larger area because it would have included Greenport in the Van Husen patent. So it was a large area that could be described today by the Hudson Greenport. But the landing itself, the actual landing itself, would have been just down at the river.
Would that be currently at sort of the South Bay, that area where the park is now?
Yes, it would be. The landing would be centered around where the boat club is located, because that was the old ferry crossing.
So the ferries were operating also, as well as...
By the 18th century, you had a ferry operating, yes.
And boats were coming up and down the river and coming through.
The ferry just went across the river.
I'm thinking whether you got furs coming down from Albany Way down here, and then being sent down.
Well, initially, the fur trade was beginning to. There was a huge change in the economy at the time that Clavering Landing was established, and that's one of the sort of confusions. There's been a lot of discussion lately about the original purchase, about the deed from the Mohican Indians, whether it was under coercion or otherwise. There was a tremendous change over from what had been the beaver pelt trade to agricultural produce. And that also impacted Native American tribes who were competing with each other for the benefits of being involved in the fur trade. So after the landing is established, the trade is basically not in beaver pelts or in pelts, but in agricultural produce.
How long were the When did the Indian Native Americans, did they kind of just leave the area?
Well, for one thing, they were decimated by smallpox, by American diseases. So that was one of the things that happened. And they slowly melted away. Now, right through the 18th century, they are around. And even today, you have the Stockbridge Indian nations. So they're still around, and they still play a role. But I think that their power waned by the late 17th century. It was pretty much gone. Now, you did have raids where Indians had sided with the French in Canada, for example. And so you did get raids into the 18th century by mostly converted, Christianized, or Catholic Indians. They were, you know...
Is there any evidence there was a raid here?
They occurred in the Kinderhook area and in some of the farms around here.
Oh, but living here was pretty... these were pioneers.
Well, initially, I mean, again, we're talking about 120 years.
So it starts at 16...
Well, 1662 is when Van Hoosen makes his purchase.
So 100, then another 100 years plus 20 is the 120.
Is when the proprietors are, well, they come in 1783.
I was wondering, they're a whole different story, but was there one family or all these families just sold the area?
Well, they sold property. They still maintain property within the area, but they sold off large sections of the area.
So they're living. You have the proprietors, but you still have the Dutch presence.
Around. Right, their homes were still here. They still lived in what became the city of Hudson.
So they were,
and they play a prominent role, and their descendants today play a prominent role.
Was it more a harmony between the two groups?
I think there was some antagonism, particularly by the Dutch. I mean, it's always the newcomers. There's always antagonism against the newcomers, and of course there's the language difference. The people from Nantucket did not speak the Dutch dialect that was here. And I'm sure that was used.
But you still had farming. You still had the agriculture around in this area. Farms still exist in parts.
Well, it still is a farming area. In the area beyond. But as you know, Hudson was established as a port for whaling vessels. The city of Hudson.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, also a major transportation, regional transportation center for the products of the interior to be sent out down to New York.
Isn't there a church in Claverick that could go way back to before the proprietors?
Oh, yeah, the Reformed Church in Claverick goes back to, I think the congregation begins in 1704, so...
Yeah. That must have been like the mother church. I mean, that's where people would come. They would probably even travel to that church.
Well, initially they would go to either Kinderhook. They would attend a congregation in Kinderhook or in Kingston to have their children baptized or to, you know.
So there are children here that were baptized in Kingston.
There were
some baptized in Claverick and Kinderhook at the Reform.
Right, which predate the Claverick Church. The churches played and religion played a central role in people's lives. That's in the pre-print era, and there was no printing presses here, and that was where you got most of your news, was through the church services and church gatherings.
People would find out through. That kind of communication when they gather together.
Right. And, of course, the church played a very prominent role in people's lives.
Would you say that the church here, was it a tolerant church over time? Did it become more tolerant or more open? Or
Well, you can't, that's trying to compare a whole different era and a whole different mentality and today's concept of tolerance.
Their tolerance was...
Right, and so it's you can't make that kind of comparison. And I mean that also there was slaveholding in this area, so, which is a whole different, you know...
So there were slaves here in
Cardiff. Yes.
There were a number of slaves.
Yeah, and not a large number. This was not a plantation economy, but people would in the census records and stuff. For example, in the 1709, you will find, slaves as well.
Were there indentured servants?
There would be indentured servants as well. I mean, you're dealing with the pre-industrial economy. You're not dealing with a modern.
So, I take it that wherever the river was. Or the creek coming through would have mills for the grain.
No, because a lot of times Clavering Landing gets a mill in the middle of the 18th century.
Oh.
But the grain would be transported to New York City to be milled down there. Now, there were monopolies.
If I was a farmer and I had wheat and I want to have bread, I have to wait for it. I have to send it down and wait for the bread to come back?
Well, no, it's not. But you can also do milling. You can also grind your grain at home and everything. But there was not, there would be very simple mills. There weren't commercial mills here that early. It's not until the 18th century that you get a full water mill here in Hudson.
Okay.
But the milling was generally monopolized in the early period. By communities. So some communities were not allowed to own, have mills.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So commerce was not, it wasn't free enterprise. It was so different.
It's very different because first off, under the Dutch, of course, it was all Dutch West India Company. And then they were allowed some leeway, but under the English as well. There was a lot of restrictions on what you could manufacture, what you could send out or bring in, which is one of the reasons why you had an American Revolution, because of the...
But the, I'm thinking the clothing, import stuff, unless they produced locally in their homes.
Now, cloth was mostly imported, and then you made it at home.
At home. The cows, the cattle could be slaughtered locally to...
Well, you were allowed to feed yourself, of course.
Yes, but there wasn't, unless they had a market down here. They had a market at this time.
This was not, there wasn't really a market economy here at that point in time.
There was no place where they'd meet in a fair or in a market.
Not. I'm sure they had, but there was not the organized markets that developed later. This was a very, very rural area.
Sparsely settled by Europeans. Mm. A lot of area that still was probably, I wouldn't say wilderness, but...
In the 17th century, development all occurred along rivers and creeks because you had to have the transportation.
Yeah.
And it's only toward the end of the 17th century you begin to get even, for example, as late as 1689, 1690, there were really no roads through the interior. There were the Indian trails that people followed, but they generally avoided them. And what happens in the 18th century, there's a massive migration that begins to occur from the east, from New England, with New Englanders moving into the eastern part of the county. And you find by the middle of the 18th century, a lot of settlement, a lot of the communities in the interior of the county being born. And that's when you get a lot of development with the highways and the roads, the roads infrastructure. Up at the time of the American Revolution, Ruth Pywonka, who recently is deceased, wrote a wonderful study showing that the county was probably as densely populated as a typical rural European county would be in England.
That's great. So I was Today I was speaking to David William Voorhees. He's the director of the Jacob Leisler Institute. We talked today quite a bit about Clovrick Landing and the first settlements, and I want to thank you so much for sharing your information and your time. It was very informative.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.